If you're running a business right now, you're playing a game where the rules keep changing. Trade tensions, economic uncertainty, culture wars, the world is rapidly changing around us. And companies, especially independent and local businesses, are having to adapt faster than ever. That's why Mission Critical is evolving. We're diving deep with the founders, CEOs, and entrepreneurs who are navigating this chaos in real time. The ones making the tough calls, pushing through unpredictability, and proving that resilience isn't just a buzzword, it's a survival skill. How do you scale in an economy that feels like it's on shaky ground? What happens when US policy shifts send shockwaves through Canadian industries? And in a world where diversity, healthcare, and economic resilience are becoming battlegrounds, how do businesses double down instead of backing down? These are the real conversations that matter to business leaders right now. I'm Lance Chung, and this is Mission Critical. Let's get into it. Hi, Dax. How are you?
I'm great.
You're visiting Toronto. What brings you to town?
Well, we've got a new book called Echoes from Eden that just came out 2 days ago.
Congratulations!
So bringing it to the TIFF crowd,
yeah,
and promoting it with NKPR at the IT Lounge, which is a gifting lounge, as well as Indigo book tour date.
Yeah,
that happened last night.
Yeah, do you feel like a rock star just like going on a book tour and like being able to spread the gospel of your book and everything?
I mean, it's been really a lot of fun. I mean, we had an amazing crowd in LA. And then just an even better crowd here in Toronto with amazing questions, super engaged folks that just want to hear that things can still be done for the planet. So the book took, you know, talks about a 2-year period from 2022 to 2024 when I stepped down as a Lightspeed CEO and became the chair and could kind of pursue this dream of investing in conservation and then going on the ground to all these places and putting my life at risk.
Yeah, yeah, no kidding.
In the Amazon to start with, and then, you know, every other crazy place after. And it's just, I'm so glad Eric and I wrote this book because it's just a time capsule of something that was a super special time. So it's fun to talk about.
Okay, well, starting there, actually, because that kind of like touched on a little preview of like everything that I wanted to talk to you about. When you talk about like life and death scenarios, what is your approach to being outside of your comfort zone, and how is that reflected in your endeavors when it comes to writing your books and your personal missions, but also your business?
Yeah, so I've learned a lot about you know my leadership style and also just being a leader at Lightspeed. Now that I'm back, it's my favorite period ever at Lightspeed, where we have a lot of work to do, but you know, being able to do this for 2 years, the conservation piece, and just actually be on the ground with what feel like startups, I've realized that the through line to everything that I really enjoy doing is that entrepreneurial spirit, right? Mm-hmm. So whether it's helping the restaurants and retail businesses that Lightspeed supports or being on the ground with these conservationists that are up against impossible odds, like a restaurant is when they open their doors.
Yeah.
It all has that same startup DNA, that kind of spirit. And of course, we were a startup
you know,
at one point, and we're always doing startup-y things inside the company. And then there's all sorts of projects within Age of Union, which is my environmental projects, that are building things from the ground up and trying new ideas. So I think that's the through line for me is starting something from zero with the odds against you. And then, you know, getting out of your comfort zone is just something you have to get used to if you are an entrepreneur at heart.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to have a comfort with risk, of course, calculated risk. And I think as you get more experienced and more seasoned, you know how to calculate the risks, not put yourself really in danger, you know, blend in with security, especially if you've been going to the gym.
Right.
when you're in the middle of Haiti, right?
Right.
So it's how to, you know, how to create the best out of those moments to learn from, because when you're out of your comfort zone, that's when you learn the most.
Yeah, yeah. And that is truly...
You're not going to learn a lot in your comfort zone and in your bubble.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to grow.
And that, I feel like that's truly the mindset of an entrepreneur, especially at a startup level, where you're like constantly trying to like solve problems that are out there that, you know, maybe there's not as... Maybe there are solutions, but not the solution that you're looking for, and just trying to find ways to create different paths. And as a result, that is going to involve putting yourself into situations that might be out of your comfort zone, even if it's in a professional setting too, right?
Yeah.
And embracing that mindset of like exploring that like feeling of like kind of not wanting to, or feeling of just like keeping things moving and, yeah. and trying to solve problems and everything.
I think you have to take risks if you want to win against impossible odds or change the game.
So you are, you know, one of those rare leaders where, you know, you sit at really this intersection, a very unique intersection that overlaps between business, community, activism. So when people think about, you know, Dax Da Silva, what do you hope is kind of the first thing that comes to mind as someone that does the work that you do?
Well, I think that, you know, many people know me from different paths, right? Mm-hmm. So in Canada, I think most people understand me as, you know, the founder of Lightspeed. Mm-hmm. But if I'm in environmental circles or film circles where we've done documentaries, there's a sort of a different understanding. I think there's some things that are the same. I think I'm engaged. I'm on the ground. I think, an approachable person, but a person that loves to lead and also create. Mm. So there's commonalities between the different versions. But yeah, there are a number of different versions.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. Yeah. Depending on where you are and who you're with.
But they're one authentic person, right? I think that we do have, I think through our lives, we water different seeds that are all different part of us, you know,
and that's the same garden.
Yeah, exactly. And things come into season at different times. Mm. They cross-pollinate each other. And so that's like all of the different pieces are authentically me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how you kind of live your maximum potential. I won't say I'm there, but I wouldn't be happy, I think, if I was only... It could only be one of those things.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, as you mentioned, Lightspeed started off as a startup and as a scrappy startup from Montreal. Mm-hmm. And it's obviously grown into a global platform that is also powering a whole network and community of other businesses. When you look back on that journey, what surprises you the most about where that journey has taken you along the way?
I mean, the scale of it is... Mm-hmm. Always surprises me. You know, we're 3,400 people. It's more than $1 billion in revenue. When I started it, my only goal was to win an Apple Design Award from Steve Jobs. I was like handcraft, like really detailed crafting pixels for the first version of Lightspeed. I was such a Mac nerd since I was 13 and a coder. And actually had no business background whatsoever and no sense that I was a leader at all. Mm. I had to grow into that. Because the team was like, well, what are we doing all this for at some point? And so I had to start figuring out how to tell them, you know, and then communicate even more broadly than that over time. So the scale of it is, you know, sometimes it takes a bit of perspective. So when I stepped back for 2 years, I came back appreciating the company on a whole other level. Because I think when you're inside something for a long time, you don't see it properly. Mm-hmm. You see it from inside the bubble. You see it for all the challenges it has. You don't see it for how incredible it is.
Yeah.
And that's why I can enjoy this like period of transformation like more than I think I've ever enjoyed any other phase of the company. But what I missed in those 2 years about Lightspeed is just like the incredible level of the people you get to work with.
Yeah.
It's extremely stimulating, you know? And so for somebody with an entrepreneurial spirit, you know, you kind of never want to have a minute when you're bored, right? You always want to have something very meaty to tackle.
Yeah.
And preferably a dozen things, you know, that are worth tackling. And Lightspeed's got, you know, no shortage of like really fascinating opportunities.
Yeah, right? Always in motion.
Yeah, always in motion.
I can only imagine also just the number of businesses and entrepreneurs that you're also powering, like the stories that are coming from there, not like externally from the company too. It's just the whole ecosystem.
Well, that's the thing that we get to enjoy as Lightspeeders that. We actually started really celebrating as of our summit. Like, we can go on the streets in North America and or in Europe for restaurants. Mm-hmm. North America, it's more retail. Mm-hmm. Europe, it's more restaurants. We can go and we can see our software being used in some of like our favorite places in the city, right? You can't do that if you're enterprise software. You can't do that when you're working in lots of different kinds of companies. You can't see your software powering something really cool.
Yeah, in action.
In action.
Yeah.
And so we actually at our company summit, we did like a Lightspeed company map. So if you're just on a street in Amsterdam, you can find all the Lightspeed customers on that street. You can go and spend your money there.
Right.
And you can feel a sense of pride.
Yeah. Right?
About, okay, I worked on that, you know, like, or I understand that workflow, or they're having a struggle and I can maybe plug them into something that could make them a better business and make us a better company by, you know, maybe addressing something that we didn't know.
Sure. And yeah. You can tangibly see the work that you've created, actually, like people using the platform and everything too.
Yeah. I mean, I think in a world where people are searching for the meaning of the things that they do and work on, mm-hmm. we're lucky because we see how our software powers community businesses that may be up against, you know, big franchises.
Yeah.
That have like enterprise software that's like cost millions of dollars. So we're kind of democratizing, you know, those kinds of tools, whether it's operations tools or AI tools or all of that. Like, we bring it so that they have a competitive advantage.
Yeah.
And you want those businesses to thrive. You don't want them all to be replaced by Starbucks and like, you know,
yeah,
the big chains.
I always talk about with my peers, like, I feel like the sign of like a really healthy neighborhood and community and ecosystem is the number of like independent businesses that you see. Yeah. And like, it might not every single independent business will be your thing, but you can always be happy about the a new business that's independent opening up in your neighborhood, because it's just totally adding to the health of an ecosystem or neighborhood.
And all that money goes back into the community and not into some foreign country, especially as we're thinking as Canadians about where our dollars end up going. Mm-hmm. You know, who does it end up helping? Mm-hmm. And then the other question that I get that's an interesting one is, okay, well, you know, you're writing about conservation, which is, you know, an environmental topic. You know, doesn't Lightspeed fuel consumerism? You know, like, well, I mean, if you're going to shop or you're going to eat out, you should eat at the businesses and shop at the businesses that are putting money back into the community, that can make the sustainable local choices more so than the multinational chains.
Yeah.
Right? We all have to consume, but those businesses have that consciousness, you know, or they strive for it, or they're more connected to the local consideration, right? So that is for me, that's the connection. Like, that's what I see in those locally owned businesses is that sensitivity and that likelihood, especially now that there's more patriotism in how businesses are stocking, you know, where they get their ingredients or supplies. You know, they're thinking about, okay, how does this help our country?
And the discovery of like other independent businesses that are also part of that fabric too.
Right.
And part of that supply chain. You don't have to rely on overseas and everything like that too, right?
Right. And also the more you do locally, the less it costs you in carbon.
And also
it's like we did a study at Lightspeed about something called value spending. Mm. And the younger you go in demographics, the more where people spend their money is aligned to some set of values, right?
Well, and people are just asking more questions.
They're asking more questions,
Looking back on kind of everything that you've built in your career and your entrepreneurial journey, how has your perspective on entrepreneurship and leadership changed and evolved, if anything? Like, what do you think is the biggest difference between those first few years and now?
I think the biggest observation that I've made this year, having been, you know, 20 years at Lightspeed, is I think at first you might second guess some of your instincts, what you feel in your gut.
Mm-hmm.
I think over time, as you do more, you trust those instincts more. You trust that wisdom that you build up from having seen a lot. And I think when you don't trust your gut, you get yourself into trouble. you know?
Has it gotten you into trouble?
Yeah.
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 It definitely has. And I think that when you're true to, when you're true to your values and you're, and you act and decide on that truth, very rarely do you go in the wrong direction. You know, when you compromise, and of course, as you're building a company, you make lots of different compromises because there's other stakeholders that want other things. Mm-hmm. And you say, I'm not going to fight that battle, or I'm not, you know, that's important to them. I'll stay in my lane on that one. You know, that's, I don't think that's a good, if I look in retrospect, those are the compromises that we're now trying to correct. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like that's that. So I think that's, That's been the evolution. There's so many different evolutions that happen as a leader in 20 years, but that's the one where having come back with a very fresh perspective, not compromising on that one. You know?
Yeah. We talked a little bit about this already, but how do you see small businesses really being kind of the source of really shaping culture in our community? And similarly, like how does something like a company like Lightspeed help to protect and empower that kind of role that small businesses play?
Well, small business is local culture. It is local identity. It's the food. It's the brands that make a place unique. That make a city unique. If everything's the same everywhere, then no city is unique. There is no identity in a place. So. That's what we do as a business is we make sure that we fuel their ambitions, mm-hmm. you know, with the technology, with the insights they need that can be competitive with these multinationals, you know, and these big chains. Otherwise, they don't have the means to compete. They don't have the means to be viable as businesses. And we know that those businesses make such a big difference in enriching a city and enriching a culture.
Mm-hmm. What do you find is the biggest pain point that businesses are facing right now? What's the feedback that you're getting?
Well, I mean, there's the things that are immediately challenges, things like supply chain, things like inflation, you know, post COVID, there's a lack of staffing. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of things that are sort of very 2025 or 2024 in terms of their, in terms of the moment. But if you look big picture, mm-hmm. Of what's happened to retail and hospitality over the last 20 years today, if you think about like 20 years ago when Lightspeed started, if you were a retail business owner, you had to find a good location. And that was like that was basically your marketing, right? You find a good location. If it's on the right street, people will walk in, mm-hmm. you know, and then the only other trick you had to do is order the right stock and make sure that there was enough, and that was about as much as you had to do. Mm-hmm. You know, very similar with a restaurant. It was like location, and have an appealing offering. And if you got those two things right, you could probably have a good business.
Right.
Today you have to be an expert. Same person. Today you have to be an expert at an incredible guest experience that has amazing reviews that you have to manage. You have to be amazing on social media, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. On multiple platforms. You have to
pretty much like a media platform,
right?
In and of yourself.
And if you really want to be a great business, you have to be have a killer social media presence.
Yeah.
You have to have an online presence so that people can order from you like on e-com. You have to know how that works. Mm-hmm. You have to know how online marketing works. And then there's all sorts of logistical complexity to running all of those channels simultaneously. And it's orders of magnitude more difficult, mm-hmm, to have a business when those are sort of the baseline for what you need to have to be successful. You know, so, and I think I'm forgetting a few things, but business has become way more complicated for a small business owner. You have to wear a lot of hats where they wouldn't have even dreamed of those things, you know, 20 years ago. And now you have to be an expert in understanding analytics, understanding insights, understanding how AI fits into it. And now you have to navigate a very difficult labor market where nobody wants to work, potentially in without a whole bunch of different requirements, it's way harder to succeed, you know?
So what kind of advice do you give to people with all that stacked up against them?
Well, the only way you can rationalize that, and I think that's true of many industries that have gotten a lot more complicated. Think about how much more complicated it is to produce a TV show or a movie, given all of the expectations from the audience, you know, like polish, CGI, like it's become orders of magnitude more expensive. The only way to offset all of that is with technology. You have to have the technology has to race forward to take more things off your plate. So, you know, that's like our mission is to make sure that they can, like a retail business owner can focus on the curation of their products so that they can like understand like what is going to attract people. They got into, let's say, selling bikes because they're passionate about bikes. They're not passionate about inventory management or e-commerce or social media necessarily. If they could take that off their plate, then they can focus on, okay, what are the cool bike brands? Let's go to the trade shows. Let's find out. Let's find what's like what's really hot. You know, what are the profit makers? And same with the restaurants. Like if somebody got into hospitality because they're super passionate about Spanish food, they should be working on the next menu creation or the next cocktail creation. Or the next mocktail creation, you know, like that's popular now. So it's not about all of the management, right? So as much as technology can take that away from what's on their day-to-day, the more they can focus on where they can actually add value. And then, of course, the business owner can actually interact with their staff and interact with the people coming to their store or restaurant. Then you get another level of, like, loyalty to that place, right? Yeah. You can really feel, like, the business owner's presence and feel that passion of that business owner.
Yeah.
But not if they're sitting behind. Nobody got into business to sit at the administration screen of Lightspeed.
Yeah. right.
They should be in their business.
You know? And if I think about some of my favorite restaurants or retail stores, it's truly the people that are the places where I feel like I can recognize the barista or the restaurant owner sitting at the bar and is like, welcomes you and remembers your order, or 100%. You walk into a store and there's someone from a retail standpoint. It's like, I know exactly what this person likes. It is like that sense of familiarity and hospitality, I guess, of being and expertise. Able to be on touch. Yeah, and expertise for sure.
Yeah. I mean, why do you go into a retail store that's like that sells bikes? It's because you've got people that are passionate about it and are experts.
Yeah.
You know? And if they're building you a recycled bike out of multiple parts, like you're not gonna be able to figure that out online.
Yeah.
You're gonna go in and it's gonna be an experience because it's also entertainment.
Yeah.
Going into a restaurant, going into retail stores, it's also a social thing to you that you do for entertainment.
Yeah.
You know, it's a part of your thing that you can talk to your friends about.
100%.
Yeah.
I want to circle back on kind of this culture and landscape around technology as well, because I think that it's a really interesting time for that. But before that, you know, you're also obviously very passionate about realms that exist beyond Lightspeed as a business when it comes to activism, community stewardship. How do you see your activism as linked to what you've built with Lightspeed? How do they connect to each other and work in tandem with each other?
I think for me, both Lightspeed and the Age of Union Conservation projects and the related film projects, I mean they all those parts inspire me, right? They inspire me as a leader. They refuel me as a leader. Everything I do at Lightspeed gives me excitement to do the Age of Union stuff and vice versa. So that's a personal thing. I think I learn a lot from the entrepreneurial journeys on both sides, from the people that are working conservation or working in small business or working inside Lightspeed, and that cross pollinates. And I think that I think that is for me like the through line. That's the connector, right? Mm-hmm. It's building something, doing the impossible, iterating, failing fast. That gets me excited.
What do you think is, you know, just building on that, something unique that business leaders can learn from conservation leaders, and also vice versa? Like, how can conservation leaders also adopt a entrepreneurial business mindset or tech leader mindset and yeah. vice versa.
Well, I mean, one thing that I learned from going on the ground to the conservation projects reminded me of how much I love being on the ground in the field with Lightspeed, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So when I came back to Lightspeed full-time as the CEO, I was like, I'm not going to be removed from the operations. I'm going to dig into operations. I'm going to dig in with customers more than I ever did in my previous time there. Because the value of it, what you can learn in a day or what you can learn in 2 weeks elevates your game. Like, you can't talk about something without understanding it, but many business leaders do, you know, and I've been at various points less understanding about an area that I had a lot of opinions about, you know. Like, I think that can actually help. That can help you waste a lot of time potentially. Mm. Not help you waste a lot of time. That can waste you time.
Yeah,
it can waste you cycles. It can cost you in terms of your business.
Right.
So. Right. I think the more time you spend on the ground in the field to get a true understanding, the quicker you can come to the right and pointed and effective and exciting solutions.
Yeah, go down to the ground floor and just mm-hmm. see what's really happening in there.
And that, I think, is like really exemplified well in what the grassroots conservationists are doing. Mm-hmm. They live it. And what you can experience with nature is that when you work with nature, it's always something that exceeds your expectations. And I think that when you are on the ground and you work deep in a company, not in the operations and with customers, you build something that is just way more competitive, way more aligned with need. Mm-hmm. And that's when businesses really, really start succeeding. It's like when you stop listening to customers, when you stop listening to your people is when you start to go way off track.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So they're very similar. I think being on the ground is important, and that persistence, that dedication, like, I find that common in terms of like what people do when they're up against great odds in conservation and in business.
Yeah, the parallels between the two. How do you manage balancing both the roles as leading like a multinational company and platform as well as leading efforts within the conservation space? Like, that's a lot for one person to manage individually. So how do you balance all that?
Well, I mean, since I've come back to Lightspeed, the projects are now managed by Leonardo DiCaprio's foundation, mm-hmm. Rewild. So that's one thing that I've done is move management over there. You know, I'm celebrating moments where a book comes out about that period, but I'm not in the field right now, mm-hmm. In the Amazon or in Madagascar, right? It's Lightspeed's the top priority. And, mm-hmm. So it's a different chapter for me. It's a business focused, chapter, but I do take a lot of inspiration from that period. It's interesting because I think my leadership was tested in totally new ways. In those 2 years, not just in the conservation piece, but also we got into filmmaking. We won an Emmy for Wildcat, you mm-hmm. know, one of the environmental documentaries.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you. I think it's approaching an area that you don't know anything about with humility, and learning something from scratch and then actually, you know, having some success in it that makes you realize, okay, apply that to business. Maybe drop all the things you think you know, approach it with a fresh perspective, and see where that takes you, you know? Because I went into conservation not knowing anything, into film knowing even less. And then by the end, you know, my goal was to work with Dr. Jane Goodall, who wrote the foreword to the book and who I've traveled to the Amazon and Africa with.
Major.
And then working with Leonardo DiCaprio, and we're doing two films together, and now he's managing all my projects. So that's like, I managed to make a lot of progress in 2 years in those fields. It just makes me excited to be able to do things with a fresh perspective at the company.
Yeah,
you know, not do things the way we always did things at the company. Like, maybe take a fresh look at all of the, you know, the opportunities. It's a perfect match for what we're doing right now at Lightspeed, which is a transformation.
Yeah. Going back to my previous note around just this landscape and dialogue around technology in the business community, you know, obviously artificial intelligence is like a huge discussion happening and changing every day. And, you know, small businesses can wield AI as much as well as large businesses in a way that can make that can be an absolute game changer. But there's also the other side of the same coin. Do you think about, you know, the given your work in conservation and everything, do you think about kind of the environmental cost of AI's kind of growing influence, you know, around like data centers, energy use, water, and how we can reconcile its benefits with the footprint that it's making on the community?
The environmental costs of AI, I mean, I think you could probably think about and compare it to early computers, mm-hmm. right? If you remember, like, the original mainframes or ENIAC or just, like, things that are probably that are older than the both of us. This is a massive room of things that sucked up energy that probably weren't as powerful as our calculator.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So if you think about, we could have had equivalent complaints about that. But would we be here today with an iPhone that could that's probably the equivalent of a trillion of those, mm-hmm. if we hadn't gone through a period where we got more and more efficient rapidly, right? And micronized everything, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think that there needs to be a journey. Like, can people have a higher consciousness about making that a goal? I think so, because I don't think that doesn't seem to be the priority of making it energy efficient. Other than it costs a lot of money, so it will. If it's going to be a viable business model, it has to have lower energy costs, lower water costs by default.
Water, yeah, especially when you consider like the communities that the water is being utilized
fair,
for too. Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
it is a really interesting conversation that's happening around this, and everything is moving so quickly.
Yeah.
Because of the speed of technology.
But I'd like to look back in 10 years and see how long sucked up a ton of water or used a lot of energy.
Yeah.
Was that a year or 2 years before we figured out how to make it a lot more cost efficient? Just because people are looking at the bottom line, not because they're, you know, environmentalists per se,
yeah.
but just because it's extremely costly to do what they're doing right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned at the beginning of our chat, just talking to people who feel like they want to make an impact but don't know how. And I think with the small business community, it's such a powerful community. I mean, it makes up the majority of the economy. But as individual businesses and as individuals leading our own businesses, even if it's a one-person team, mm-hmm. it can feel like, especially in this world that we're in today, there are a lot of problems that feel just completely like even just abstract. Like it's hard to even quantify it or even figure out a starting point to figure out how to make a difference or an impact. So what would you say to other entrepreneurs who want to really integrate a sense of activism and impact into the DNA of their business and just don't know where to start because they're just so overwhelmed with everything, all the noise around them?
I mean, there's really strong parallels there with conservation. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a number of stories, which I could share with you, about how activism from ordinary people got laws changed. You know, we did a film that had only two screenings. It's a short film, YouTube film, our second short film about dolphins dying on the coast of France. We didn't even know how to make a film. We did a short documentary and a documentation of Sea Shepherd France's campaign. So big trawlers were coming from Europe and Asia, sucking up all the fish along the French coast. Dolphins would go closer to the coast and get caught in the French fishing fleet, which never happened before, and were dying like 10,000 a year and would wash up. Sea Shepherd France took those, you know, this is just a small group of people. Sea Shepherd France took those dolphin bodies to the foot of the Eiffel Tower, to the foot of the National Assembly. We released a film. We played it at the Grand Rex in Paris. It had only one screening, and then we screened it here at TIFF. And there was so much embarrassment in the part of the government that we got the law changed,
wow.
you know, within 6 months. So it shows, and that was not a very, that was an effort, but it shows the power of individual action. It shows that when you make something a priority or you embarrass the government or, you know, you call upon business leaders, you can make things change.
Yeah.
You know, and so can small businesses. But you need to have some organization and you need to you know how to, you need to know how to get the communications out there. And there is a lot of ways now, right? Yeah. Everybody's got their own channel. You can pick your channel.
Yeah.
It can be Instagram. It can be TikTok. It can be YouTube. It can be, you know, there's no shortage of people having personal platforms.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's a lot that can be done. And I think it's just maybe people getting over a sense of powerlessness and maybe reference a couple of examples of how people broke through the noise and made something happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I was talking to on a previous episode, Jonathan Van Ness from Queer Eye, and talking about a similar topic about, you know, how do you try to implement change when it just feels like everything is there's so much chaos and things feel out of your control. And they were talking about how they referenced an example of like someone that they grew up with, had a huge influence. I think it was like a teacher, a community leader, and without that person, they may not have been in a position that they are in today because that person was able to guide them. And I think the bigger picture, the bigger message is that like sometimes the biggest impact you can make is the one that is like within arm's reach, and you don't even know what kind of like ripple effect that can have afterwards. And that you don't have to try to tackle these huge problems, because sometimes just trying to like work with something that is within your grasp is the best way to start. And it's just, it seems to be true when you think about a lot of change that has happened historically as well too. Yep. And things that mm-hmm. grow into grassroots movements.
Yeah. You don't like, for example, you know, we did like a couple of book dates. You know, there was a lot of people excited by a lot of ideas that were discussed in those group conversations. You don't know how many people are now inspired to like take action in something that may not even be related. You know, like there's a lot of ripple effect, you mm-hmm. know, to the things you put out there that you'll never know. You'll never know the paths that people went on, and maybe it just accumulates with a couple things that they've heard on podcasts, plus they mm-hmm. heard it from mm-hmm. you, plus they, you know, so there is that. But I think that there's also something to be said about standing up on something that needs immediate attention, and it can't wait for a ripple effect.
Right.
You have to act.
One, something has to start the ripple too.
Something has to, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you've got a new book out, Echoes from Eden. Thank you for bringing this. It's beautiful. I was admiring the weight of this book. It is great.
It's one of the first books. I love a hefty book.
Can you just tell me a little bit? I mean, we've touched on this in the interview, but can you tell me a little bit more about it and just kind of the core messages and really like what you hope people walk away from, mm-hmm. from, you know, reading through it?
So it documents the 2-year period, 2022 to 2024, where I invested $40 million to 10 conservation projects and then decided to go on the ground with all of them. And so having not done anything like any of that, it's a pretty big personal growth journey. The first chapter. It was like really well written in the Globe and Mail. And the first, as you're, you know, going into this story, you know, Dax is like pushing his van out of ditches in the Amazon. Then he's like, you know, going down a river that's like surrounded by caimans. Then he's like sleeping under bats. Then he's like, that's the first chapter, right? Yeah. So it's just like, I read it and I'm like, wow, I'm surprised I'm still in one piece. Because I can't even swim, right? So yeah, okay. It's not really the person you'd volunteer, you know, like to do all that.
Yeah.
So I think it is what I think is the core message of this is the book's not about me. Yeah, it's about my personal journey. It's about the heroes in the book. Mm-hmm. It's about these people that are, yeah, there's a couple biologists, but there's a lot of ordinary individuals that decided, I'm not going to let this forest fall if I can do something about it. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to let these species go extinct if I can fist fight on the beach to save these leatherback turtles that are being butchered as they're coming to lay eggs.
Yeah.
You know, like that there's whatever your personal mission is, whether it's starting a small business or whether it's like fighting for something, in the, you know, in whatever community you're in, those stories of personal action and the power of the individual is like a core part of that book. It's also the core message. We have a lot of gloom and doom on the environment. Every one of those stories proves that this is not the time to give up. A lot mm-hmm. can be done. Mm-hmm. Even destroyed environments can come back because nature is more powerful than we think. Mm-hmm. And when we work with nature and ally with nature, it can be restored faster than you believe. And then for the pristine areas, we've got to do everything to protect these last wild places. You know, so there's mm-hmm. the environmental piece, but there is, I think, most people that are looking for an inspiring read are going to love the heroes in this story.
What's like a particular kind of story of like resilience that really sticks out to you from this experience? Doesn't have to be your favorite, but something that sticks out and you think will really resonate with people.
Yeah, I just touched on it. It was like, so it's the chapter on Trinidad. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know if you know what if you ever seen a leatherback turtle or know what it is. It's like it's the size of a Kia, right? It's they can grow up to a ton. We don't know that much about them. They disappear into the ocean, and the only time we ever see them is when the mothers come up every 5 or 6 years to lay eggs. Mm. And they only start laying eggs at age 30, right?
Oh.
Yeah. And we don't know how long they live, and we never see the males again. And so Suzanne Lacan-Baptiste grew up on Matura Beach, and she witnessed these mothers coming up on the beach to lay eggs. But at a certain point, young men started to decide that they were going to take advantage of the nesting season and just butcher these mothers, cut them up for meat, and steal all the eggs. And so it mm-hmm. went from a maternity ward to a graveyard. Mm-hmm. And she was like, this is not going to happen. And she fist fought these young men and fought for this area and forced the government to protect it. It was a very big battle. But you fast forward to today, and that whole community now is back to being a nursery. And the whole town and all of those young men are working to make sure that these turtles make it. And it's become an attraction for people that want to take tours and learn and watch these mothers on this incredible, you know, in these incredible moments. And so that's like one individual that is extraordinary, but not a scientist, you know?
Sure.
And she's just changed the trajectory and has probably inspired so many young people and a lot of young women. Like, I mean, when we went down there with our group, we saw all these young women and girls watching and like thinking about their future of what they want to do. Dr. Jane Goodall wrote the foreword the last chapter is our journey into the Amazon to meet Chief Juma Shapaya, and just learning and absorbing what she's learned about changing the world. And she went from a researcher that didn't have a biology degree to being a legend, you know, that travels 300 days a year to spread a message that if she could reach one more person, and she just spoke in Toronto like 2 nights ago.
Yeah.
We had coffee the next day. Like, that is somebody who lives in absolute and pure service
for planting seeds
for something bigger than all of us.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's so much inspiration to be taken from these folks, whether they're famous or not famous. It's about them.
I love that. I mean, you know, you've had close encounters with gorillas, caimans, wild ecosystems, and you didn't know how to swim during that whole experience.
Still don't.
What do you think those moments teach you about just like humanity's relationship with nature overall?
We're disconnected.
Hmm.
I think in our society, you know, we have over time disconnected from we've become further and further from nature, but we've also disconnected from our communities, you know, organized religion, maybe for some good reasons. Like, we've kind of disconnected from a lot of things as we've modernized, but now we find ourselves quite unanchored because we've disconnected from nature and we've disconnected from spirituality,
which is ironic because we have so many means of connecting now more than ever, but also we are now more disconnected than ever as a result of that.
And we're lonelier.
Yeah.
And we are more disconnected from things, as you say, than ever, right? And mm-hmm. so how does one get reconnected to something that's bigger that's nature, that's spiritual. I mean, the answer is that nature and spirituality are the same thing. Mm-hmm, it's mm-hmm. the oneness and interconnectedness of things. And so if you're feeling unanchored, nature is a way back to feeling a part of that, you know, a part of something bigger. And then fighting for nature is, I think, one of the highest callings, in my opinion, because your concern is not just for the immediate, you know, because we're such an individualistic society. Mm-hmm. It's focusing on other creatures, the health of the planet, forests, waterways, all the things we rely on that we forget are dependence on, mm-hmm. right? We just think that we're fine, right? Like we can build cities and like we'll be fine. Well, the planet's dying around us and there's cities running out of water.
Yeah, and future generations and too. And
things are on fire.
Yeah.
You know, things are, Canada, one part of Canada's on fire at every point in the year now. If you did a time lapse of like all the fires around the world, this time period would look like the whole planet's on fire. So we may think, you know, it's overwhelming to see how much is on fire at any given time, but globally things are roughly more on fire than ever. It's not normal.
I remember growing up and like I grew up in Alberta and it's weird because now it feels like fire, like forest fire season is like an actual annual season that you just come to mm-hmm. accept because it just happens every year. Whereas growing up, like it was not like that. And it was not every year that you would expect that.
Right.
And things change. Yeah.
But this isn't the time to get depressed about the environment. It's not the time to give up. Like I'm really skeptical when I hear that some like, tech bro thinks that they're going to pull carbon out of the atmosphere with some machine when mm-hmm. we know what works. Nature works, you know, and actually the Canadian government's gotten wise to this. The way we do agriculture, the way we do forestry, the way we do a lot of things can be done to suck carbon out of the air, right? Mm-hmm. There's just like, there's mangroves, like there's so many things that we could be doing that are nature-based and all the conservation as well. Right. All of this is the stuff that can buy us 5 to 10 years and reduce. I mean, forests create rain. Yeah. I mean, have we forgotten that? I don't think maybe people don't know that.
Yeah.
You know, like I've been to parts of the Amazon that have been destroyed and the rain stops. You know, like it's not just because it's in that area that it rains automatically. It can dry up if you cut things down.
Right.
And what have we done? You know, like we've replaced forested areas with cities. But if you look at a lot of forward-looking cities, they've got trees everywhere, right? And we can do that.
Yeah, the foliage around the city, yeah.
And actually, Canadian cities are a lot better than European cities where they haven't done a lot of trees in the city. You, like, walk around parts of Paris or in Germany. Like, we have a lot more going on, and I think that in Canada, we can actually lead and make sure that we're building a future that's not going to be on fire and that's going to manage. Also, water is a problem too, right? Like you can have flooding.
Yeah.
And that's, those are things that feel like we are things are out of control or out of balance.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we've been talking about, your leadership in business as well as, community stewardship from like an environmental and conservation standpoint, but you're also one of the few openly queer tech CEOs, especially when Lightspeed was founded. How has that shaped your experience as a leader?
I mean, I think it's just another one of those authentic parts of me that like attracts a lot of people to the company because everybody feels like they can bring their true self to work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the first four people at the company, including myself, were from the LGBTQ community. And so our philosophy was always we want everybody that joins to feel like they have a fair shot at opportunity. And that's what DEI means to us. It's nothing more, nothing less. You know, it's not quotas. It's not anything more than if you work hard, you have a fair shot at opportunity. And you see it in the statistics of the company. The highest ranking value on our employee surveys is that like 87 to 90% of people at Lightspeed, no matter what country, feels they can bring their authentic self to work. I mean, that was like what I wanted for the company from day one,
mm-hmm.
so that I could be myself,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And you're not going to be able to do the best work of your life if you don't feel that way, right? So I think that's, I think that's like the core value of the company. If there is to be one, like a core identity piece. Mm-hmm. And from there, I think flows just incredible contributions from Lightspeeders.
What advice would you give, you know, to younger queer individuals who are entering spaces where they may not see themselves reflected or see as many examples of people like them in senior leadership positions or decision-making roles? What advice do you give to them in terms of, you know, not only just existing and being able to do good work, but also opening doors behind them as well?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a lot of experience with, I've never worked in any other companies, so I'm not sure that I have a lot of like advice grounded in experience, but I think you have to fight for who you are and set an example, and also open doors behind you, as you said, like that's how change happens. And I think you should, you know, for a lot of companies have turned their back on, you know, since there's been a rightward swing down south, they've turned their back on DEI programs that are no longer relevant. Well, I mean, the diversity in society hasn't changed. And that's still, you know, that is still an important value for almost every demographic, especially the younger demographics. And so the world will change. And companies that don't value the beauty of our diversity are going to suffer. You know, like they won't attract the best people. They won't get the most creativity and genius out of their people. You know, if they can't be authentic, then you're only hiring a part of the person. You know, it's those companies will have they will have less of their they'll have less engagement, and I think they'll be less successful.
Yeah, especially if people can't feel like they can bring them their full selves to their work. So we've covered a lot in our interview, but I kind of want to just end it with asking, just, you know, between everything that you're working on, what would you say ultimately is like your mission with the work that you're doing, and how does it all connect it together?
I think there's sort of immediate things that I want to do for the company. You know, mm-hmm. I think the company's at an incredible moment where there's so many areas where if we reveal our true potential, we'll unlock a ton of value, and that's an exciting path for the company, but it's also like an extension of this growth path that I'm personally on. Right. And that growth path goes through the early days of Lightspeed. It goes into these conservation journeys, into these film journeys, and now back to the company. And so what I want for myself is to be able to see a lot of the seeds that I've kind of planted over the years, like really be everything that they can be. I love that I was able to capture this period of time doing the conservation journey in Echoes from Eden, because like we discussed, people want inspiration. They want to know about what they can do as individuals. And I think we've connected it well. Like, it's those individuals in small business. It's those individuals in conservation. It's those individuals in activism. You know, that's what my personal mission is like, yes, it's the startup DNA, but it's like the power of the individual. It's the power of taking initiative and making things happen, right?
Yeah. Well, it's a beautiful Eden that you're growing. So thank you so much for everything that you're doing and just, you know, empowering so many people in a really challenging time right now. So really appreciate your time chatting with us today.
A lot of fun.
Thanks so much, Dax.
That's a wrap on this episode of Mission Critical. If today's conversation gave you something to think about, do me a favor. Subscribe, leave a review, and share it with someone who needs to hear it. Big ideas are meant to be shared, and the best insights only matter if they're put into action. Until next time, stay sharp, stay curious, and go and make something happen. I'm Lance Chung, and this is Mission Critical.